Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimachu, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Sam, and our producer, Hartley Litsky. Say hi, guys.
Hello. Hey, Chris.
It's too late for me, man. All right. Our guest tonight is Dr. Eileen Rayner, who will discuss laryngeal malacia. But before we get there, Sam, do you want to remind us what the show is about?
I'd be happy to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest tonight. Dr. Rayner established the pediatric ENT program at Duke in 2009, and now she works with APPs, residents, medical students, all on patient care, education, and research. She manages children with all aspects of otolaryngologic problems, including hearing loss, and she is part of the Duke Children's Hearing Center. She's active in the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery and the American Academy of Pediatrics, where she serves as the Advocacy Committee Chair for the AAP Otolaryngology Subspecialty Section. Tonight, Dr. Rayner teaches us when we should call ENT for a scope, and that thankfully most kids with laryngeal malacia are going to be just fine.
All right, folks, shall we stride into our main discussion?
Definitely.
Let's just not get too noisy about it.
Ooh.
Hello, Dr. Rayner. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you all for having me.
So first, because we're an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name? Is Eileen okay?
Absolutely.
All right. So, quickly, just for our audience to get to know you a little better, could you give us, a couple lines about yourself and maybe something outside of medicine that you like to do?
Sure. So I do pediatric otolaryngology at Duke and have been there for going on 16 years. I have lots of hobbies and interests. I've been taking piano lessons for the last 27 years. I do indoor rock climbing. I do crafting. I like to travel a lot. I like to read a lot. And I'm learning Spanish on Duolingo.
Wow. That's awesome. Just like the pure Renaissance physician, right?
Life's not a test drive.
I would love to hear from you. I'm a learner myself, and I'd love to hear what is the best advice that you have gotten either as a learner or now as an educator or just in your career?
I think managing your time as best you can. And I'm not great at this part, but knowing when to say no to things and when your plate is too full. I just tend to make more time happen somehow. But I think it's easy to get yourself overextended. So if you really are not sure you can complete the task or commit to it fully, it's better to say no than to let somebody down at the end. And just really think through your priorities so that you can accomplish the things that need to get done by the time they're supposed to be done. And that's true for your life too, in terms of just like family commitments and other things. And it makes it a lot easier to sort of have that imaginary work-life balance.
Well, we're very grateful that you said yes to us.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely doing the saying no thing, and it actually feels quite good. This is, as an attending, I don't have to, do various things that I don't want to do to try to, achieve or make it to the next level in some ways. And so that's been really, really nice. Although I think you're selling yourself short by saying you're not very good at this by all the hobbies that you do. You must have created some time in a lot of places to those.
Definitely. That's my superpower.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. That should have been our next question. What's your superpower?
Although I would say the extension of saying no is also knowing when to step away too. Like, sometimes you get into something that you thought you would like, but then you realize you don't. And also, it's okay to have an exit strategy. No one expects you to continue to do things that you really hate or really don't enjoy, because it probably doesn't help anyone. So I think that's something important as well.
Yeah.
you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties, for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, and therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from that documentation. Just imagine the feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. So get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. Go to freed.ai and enter code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month.
All right, we got a lot to cover. This is going to be... I'm so excited for this. Hartley, do you want to start with our case and then we'll take it from there?
Absolutely. So you are working today at the Cashelak Children's Outpatient Clinic, and you see baby Strider for his 6-week well baby visit. His parents report that over the past few weeks, they've just noticed some noisy breathing that seems to get louder when he's laying on his back or when he's feeding. He doesn't seem like he's having trouble breathing, and he's breastfeeding well. He's been gaining weight appropriately, but still his parents are kind of concerned and asking you about the noise. So let's start from the very beginning. Can you tell us a little bit about what is laryngomalacia and what causes it?
Sure. So laryngomalacia is where there is floppy tissue overlying the glottis or the vocal cords. It can be because the arytenoids are floppy or the corniculate cartilages are kind of tall and fold inwards. It can be because the airy epiglottic folds that connect the epiglottis to the arytenoids are short, and so that with inspiration, all of it pulls together and causes obstruction. And it can also be from the epiglottis itself, where it's omega-shaped or curled up like a little rolled-up cigar, and that can also cause obstruction. And you can have one or all of those conditions that impact inspiratory breathing. A cause of laryngomalacia isn't actually really well known. Some people feel like it's lower tone. Some people feel it's neurological development and decreased neurological inputs into the motor end plates. But nobody really knows 100% what the cause is. And it is a diagnosis that's made by visualizing the vocal cords and the glottis. So you can presume it, but you can't really definitively diagnose it without looking.
So when you say we don't know what causes it, but you can presume, it sounds like maybe based on your symptoms that you may have an idea. Are there certain things that you would see in a child that may increase their risk and therefore increase your pretest probability that you're presuming that they have laryngomalacia?
So the clinical things are usually you'll notice inspiratory stridor as opposed to expiratory or biphasic stridor. It's common for it to happen during or right after feedings. We always ask families, are they taking breaks during feedings, whether they're breast or bottle feeding? Do they frequently spit up? Are you noticing any retractions, either pretracheal retractions or sternal retractions or intercostal retractions? Obviously, we ask them that in not those terms. We look for cyanotic episodes, so lip changes or fingers or hands color changes, any obstruction with sleep. Are they having pauses in their breathing during sleep? Is it worse when they're agitated? Is it worse in certain positions, laying flat versus side-lying position? And when they come into clinic, I always double check their growth chart to see, are they actually growing appropriately? Or are they having any problems with failure to thrive?
And so it seems like the symptoms, when we think about like, what are the symptoms here? Let me back up a second. It seems like the main problem, whatever the anatomic issue is there's an obstructive process. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. And then the symptoms of obstruction we're seeing is kind of what you're referring to as inspiratory stridor and as well as difficulty feeding, gaining weight, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about why you get something like inspiratory stridor and what that is?
So essentially it is blockage of airflow during inspiration. So during inspiration, the vocal cords should open to allow airflow from the throat and the pharynx into the trachea. And when you have this floppy tissue kind of obstructing it, it creates turbulence. And that's what causes the noise that you're hearing. And the more turbulence you get, the louder the noise. It's like having something in your fan, in your air conditioning duct, and you're hearing this sort of fluttering, and then you turn off the vent and it stops. So that's the same. I use a lot of analogies so parents can understand what I'm talking about. And there are different types of stridor, but inspiratory stridor due to laryngomalacia is the most common cause of stridor in infants.
And before we get into more questions about stridor, because I actually do, I just wanted to follow back up with Chris's question that was more about like which babies are the highest risk for these, in the sense that, you know, you mentioned like multiple different ways that you can have a different abnormality that kind of falls onto that area of the vocal cord. Is there any baby that's known to have that more than anyone else, you know, preemies or, you know, I don't know, any congenital abnormalities, anything like that that we should know about?
So refluxers are a little bit more at risk for it, because with reflux, it generates inflammation, which then causes some swelling of those floppy tissues. And then that causes more obstruction. Then they work harder to breathe, which causes more reflux. So that can be a co-founder or confounder of this. Premature babies have a slightly increased risk of having laryngomalacia, but it can happen in term infants. There's not any known like genetic predisposition to it. The good news is most babies do outgrow it.
Yeah. So let's go back to stridor for a second. I'm really curious, and I think maybe the audience for this is a little bit more of our like trainee listeners. You know, we talk a lot about inspiratory and expiratory and biphasic stridor and what the differential look like for all of those things. Can you just talk about sort of how you think about stridor and what else gets on that list for an otherwise well baby who's presenting for stridor?
Right. So you can insert anything that could potentially cause airflow turbulence or obstruction. So if they do have inspiratory stridor, the most common thing, like I said, is laryngomalacia. But vocal cord paralysis may cause that. Laryngeal or glottic cysts can cause that. A lingual thyroid or a thyroglossal duct cyst in the vollicular cyst can cause that. So anything that sits in the area of the supraglottis above the vocal cords that either physically pushes down the epiglottis or squeezes the epiglottic folds or narrows the glottic inlet, any of those things can cause stridor. Interestingly, laryngeal clefts, which cause feeding problems, also may present with stridor. And that's because you have excess tissue at the area of the laryngeal cleft that sort of vibrates and can contribute to that.
Gotcha. What about expiratory or biphasic stridor?
So biphasic stridor generally indicates like a fixed obstruction, and most typically that's going to be in the area of the subglottis, so right below the vocal cords. And that's because the cricoid is the only complete ring in the airway, so it is a fixed diameter. And if it's either congenitally narrowed or if there's scar tissue there or something else like a hemangioma, those can cause biphasic stridor. So subglottic stenosis is essentially a catch-all phrase of something causing blockage just below the vocal cords. And then expiratory typically is in the trachea. So it could be tracheomalacia or bronchomalacia, which is sort of floppy tissue in the trachea or in the bronchi. I always tell parents it's sort of like having a wet straw, and after a while you can't get anything through it because it sort of sticks together. And that may be related to some external compression, like a vascular anomaly, or it could be just internal where there's either floppy cartilage because they're immature, or there's some issue with the esophagus where it's kind of pushing up into the trachea. So those are some of the causes of that. The other thing that sometimes will cause that is a condition like complete tracheal rings or even tracheal stenosis.
Can I ask a practical question here? Babies are really small, and sometimes noises sort of reverberate throughout their entire little tiny body. Could you, you know, help, you know, some of our listeners, you know, maybe we have med students or maybe 40-year-old med peds doctors who are not so great at physical exam skills. Could you walk me through exactly, you know, maybe some technique And other things that you would do to, as you're doing a physical exam on a baby, to try and identify whatever stridor is versus, you know, upper airway noises versus, oh, they're wheezing. Like, is that possible?
Sure. So the common thing parents will come in and say is that the baby sounds like they're congested all the time. That's like one of the most common presentations. And so then the keys are to try to figure out, like, when does it really worse and what are triggers of it? So that can kind of give you a general idea of maybe a differential, because inspiratory stridor can sometimes be obvious and sometimes not. And it can sound like sort of high-pitched, sort of an inspiratory noise, but other times it does sound like kind of this chronic snorty, snotty congestion. And so this is where it can get a little bit tricky without actually looking to see what's going on. You can listen with a stethoscope over the larynx, and you can listen at the subglottis. Biphasic stridor is probably the easiest of all of those to hear because it's just noise in and noise out. So when the baby calms down, you're still hearing the noise in and the noise out. With inspiratory stridor, usually if it's not severe and the baby calms down, it goes away. With expiratory stridor, that can sort of be confused a little bit with wheezing as well, because it tends to be more tracheal and bronchial. So usually like you're like a longer expiratory phase, and it's easier if you listen to their lungs and then sort of over their chest with the stethoscope than just trying to hear it in the room. You can hear it in the room in some cases, but in those cases, it's probably easier to listen with a stethoscope than just trying to listen.
Whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and maybe a fun pun in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day today as a hospitalist, and that's FIGS. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIGS scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV that may or may not take place in Pittsburgh, PA, yep, they're in FIGS too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that FIGS are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times and they still look brand new. So Cribsiders listeners, with back-to-school season upon us, it's the perfect time to stock up on some fresh outfits for the year. And FIGS just dropped a brand new collection of limited edition styles and accessories. So get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. FIGSRX.
You know, I think I'm going to jump a little bit to the diagnosis component because you had mentioned that you need to visualize it. You know, I was wondering if you could kind of walk through, for us who are very not good at anatomy and don't do scopes constantly, can you kind of walk us through what that visualization is and kind of what you're seeing when you're doing that?
Sure. So if we are suspecting it to be a supraglottic or even potentially a subglottic problem, frequently we can see it with an awake baby and a flexible scope. If it's something we think is going to be distal, below the vocal cords, below the subglottis, we probably would not be able to see it that way. So in the more common case of like laryngomalacia, the parents come in, we do our exam, we talk to the families, and then what we'll do is we'll actually put a skinny scope in their nose. I always look in both sides to rule out like choanal atresia, where they, and then they're working even harder because they only have one nose to breathe through, one side of their nose. And so we'll look in the nose, we'll look at the nasopharynx, and then we kind of go around behind the palate, and you can see the tongue and the epiglottis, and then you can hover right over the vocal cords and you just watch them breathing. And we can see the vocal cords open and close, and you can see the movement of the arytenoids in the epiglottis. You'll see them swallow. With laryngomalacia, what'll happen is when they open, everything's wide open and you can see clearly. And when they close, everything squishes together. If it's subglottic stenosis, it will be open when they open. And when they close, you'll see the vocal cords when they're closed. They don't get squished. But when you have that open view, you'll see narrowing right below the vocal cord. So you'll actually see some kind of a smaller diameter than you would expect to. But the distal stuff, usually you would not be able to see with a flexible scope like that. And you really can't put a scope through the vocal cords on an awake child that's not anesthetized and not create some problems.
And then is there any diagnostic criteria when you do the scope, or is it just like, I've done this, you know, through my 5 years of ENT training, and so therefore I know what I'm looking for?
I may need you to clarify that question just a little better, because I'm not 100% sure exactly what it is you need me to answer.
Gotcha. I mean, like, so is there like, okay, this, you know, it's narrowed by 20%, or it's narrowed by 50%, or it's narrowed by 75%, or this is, has something that's, I mean, I actually don't know what I'm looking for because I don't do this, but, you know, is there something specific that you see that does this, or you kind of say, it looks like this is a little bit more narrow than it should be, or this is collapsing, and so therefore in my clinical judgment, I'm saying this is going to be a diagnosis of laryngomalacia.
So with laryngomalacia, there's three types that are described, and I kind of mentioned them at the very beginning. You have floppy arytenoids, so the posterior part of the vocal cords attached to the arytenoid cartilages, and the arytenoid cartilages, I tell parents, it's like a hinge on a door. So it allows the vocal cords to swing open and close. They sit on top of the cricoid cartilage, so they rock out and in to let the vocal cords kind of abduct and adduct. And when they're floppy, they kind of fall forward. So when the vocal cords open, those arytenoids kind of fall into the airway. The other type is where the arytenoid AE folds are short. So then when the vocal cords are open, you can see fine, but when they close, everything squeezes together. And that's probably the most common type, short area of glottic folds. And then the last is either floppy epiglottis, where it's retroflex, so it flops down over the vocal cords and kind of covers it, or it's omega-shaped or furled up like a rolled-up cigar, and that flops into the airway and then obstructs it from the top and the front. And you can have one or any combination of those. And the type isn't as important except if we're going to actually repair it, as to the severity. So the severity really is determined by the baby's symptoms, if they're having apneas, if they're having failure to thrive, if they're having significant retractions. So we go more by the severity of the symptoms and the impact than what we see with the scope for that.
So, you know, we were talking earlier that, you know, we can have a presumptive diagnosis of laryngomalacia based on our symptomatic assessment, you know, and then with the capabilities you have, especially with scopes, you can actually better assess like the actual diagnosis. Like, do I always have to send an ENT for this to happen? Or can I be like, the baby's okay, probably laryngomalacia, wave my hand and be like, yeah, they'll grow it. Or should I be like, you know, it might be it. We just have to get you assessed. Like, where would we be, where should we start thinking about referral? Is there something we should do before referral?
So I think it depends, again, on the severity. A lot of them will start presenting around 2 weeks of age or so. And typically they might get a little worse between 3 and 4 months of age. So I would definitely recommend kind of closer follow-up than maybe seeing them every 3 or 6 months. And that can be done by the primary care provider if the baby's growing well and otherwise doing well. If they are starting to flatten out on their growth curve, if the parents are starting to really get concerned, if they're reporting apneas or retractions, if it doesn't seem like it's starting to improve, those would be good reasons to send them for a further evaluation. First of all, to confirm the diagnosis, and then also to see if there's any other recommendations that can help the parents and the baby get through the period there.
I think that's a perfect transition into like one of the recommendations that an ENT would do when they see this patient, you know, off the bat. If you could kind of talk a little bit about, you know, your first line treatments and or the natural history of this disease, that'd be helpful.
Right. So frequently we will recommend doing at least reflux precautions. And the reason, like I said before, is that babies spit up frequently. If they have increased intra-abdominal pressure from working harder to breathe, they're going to spit up more. That can generate some glottic edema, which then can make the laryngomalacia worse. So we might recommend reflux precautions like feeding upright, keeping them upright after feedings, side-lying sleeping, sometimes even inclined sleeping can help. We used to put them on reflux medicine pretty liberally, but after all of the kind of complications that came out over time with reflux medicines, we have backed away from that. We still will do that occasionally and put them on a reflux medicine in the evening typically, because then they're laying down, and so they're more likely to reflux overnight than first thing in the morning. In some cases, we may even may recommend thickening their feedings if they're not just breastfeeding, if they're bottle feeding. There's a couple of options out there. The AAP has one called Gel Mix. They liked, I don't think there is another name for that, but that has some, that can be used to thicken breast milk as well as formula.
Is there like a stepwise approach? You sort of listed a whole bunch of options. I mean, is it like, oh, you know, all right, we'll try some different sleeping positions and that's not working. Now we'll start doing thickened feeds. And if that doesn't work, we'll do some anti-reflux medications. Or is it really per patient, sort of looking at them, knowing what you've probably seen on the examination with the scope? How do you go about that?
So I actually typically follow these children pretty closely. So I'll see them about once a month, once every 6 weeks, depending on the severity of their initial presentation, and see how they're doing with their growth. And then depending on a lot of that, decide what our next steps are. If they really are having significant problems, we may skip a lot of those and just talk about, you know, surgical options. But if they're doing really well, we may not have to do any of those things other than positioning, especially like feeding positioning, because we know they're going to get better. I always tell parents to expect, you know, after about 3 months, things should start really turn the corner. And by 6 months, they should be significantly better. And as they get better, we'll space out their visits. But I will typically follow them until the symptoms completely resolve at around a year or so. So it is sort of stepwise, but a lot of it is also going to depend on how severe they are, either at their follow-ups or even at their initial presentation. A lot of children who may have underlying neurological conditions may have worse symptoms that don't follow that pattern and don't get better quickly and may need a more invasive intervention than something like positioning.
And you had just mentioned, you know, before we get into surgical options, you had mentioned that, you know, these symptoms will probably be gone by a year, you know, if we can kind of keep everything under control, do a good job, you know, see them frequently, do all the kind of things that you're mentioning about anti-reflux to go along with some other things. Why does it get better at a year for our listeners?
I think a lot of it is really related to growth and improved musculoskeletal tone. So their larynx gets bigger, the epiglottis gets stronger, the cartilages get stiffer. The airy epiglottic folds get longer, so the distance from the epiglottis to the arytenoid is also longer. The vocal cords also grow. So it's just a matter of growth and strength and time, and their muscles are stronger. So they're swallowing better. They start swallowing solids, things like that. So that's pretty much the main reason why it improves over time and eventually just goes away.
And I imagine if some kids more hypotonic or have difficulties with growth over time due to their other medical comorbidities, for example, it could take longer, or do you generally see it almost all being gone by a year?
It could take longer, but I would say the majority of them will get better within about a year.
So then at that, your age, is that when you would be like, I'm, you know, oh, we had done this thickened food or we had done the reflux medicines. That's when you do trials off of it to see how well the infant or the child does by then?
I would probably even do it sooner than that, because usually you'll see significant improvement from 6 months to a year. You'll see pretty drastic improvement. So I wouldn't wait until they're a year old to stop those things. Since we're off monitoring them, if they're doing well, I would start weaning them off stuff sooner.
You know, and I definitely want to talk about surgical options, but as far as treating the underlying illness goes, it sounds like getting bigger, stronger, sounds like number one treatment. And then number two treatment sounds like would be surgery, you know, if you're trying to treat underlying diseases. Like, what are the surgical options that you're talking about when you talk about these with these patients?
So we always do a airway scope, because up to 8% of these babies could have what we call a secondary airway lesion, whether that's bronchomalacia or tracheomalacia or some other issue. And so we will do what we call a laryngoscopy, bronchoscopy, where they are put under general anesthesia. They're spontaneously breathing. And we look with a camera through the vocal cords into the trachea, down to the carina, and down the right and left mainstem bronchus for any other lesions. And then, depending on what we see, we also check for a laryngeal cleft, which is an indentation in the cricoid behind the vocal cords, which also can contribute to feeding problems and aspiration and make stridor worse. So we'll check for that, which that is something that is fixable. And the most common procedure is something called a supraglottoplasty. And depending on what type of laryngomalacia we saw, which we had talked about those different sort of areas of obstruction, the supraglottoplasty is sort of tailored to address those areas. So the most common is the short area epiglottic folds, and we'll divide those area epiglottic folds and sort of stretch them out. So then when the vocal cords are kind of coming, opening and everything's kind of pulling, you have less pull in so that it improves the airflow through the glottis.
Hey, Croupsiders listeners, fuel your day with food that works just as hard as you do with Factor. As a pediatrician, my days can be unpredictable. Clinic visits, hospital rounds, late night charting. Sometimes I barely have time to eat, let alone cook something healthy. Between patient care and family life, convenience often wins out, and that's why I'm a big fan of Factor meals. Factor makes eating smarter easy with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to my door. No prep, no cleanup, just real food that keeps me going. Whether I'm grabbing a meal between shifts or trying to eat something substantial before heading into a long day, Factor helps me fit in something nourishing. So they now offer over 65 weekly meals, including Mediterranean diet options, GLP-1 friendly meals, and bold new Asian-inspired dishes. And for seafood lovers like me, you can even get premium picks like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. I generally use Factor, and I think you should too. So Cribsiders listeners, eat smart at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off. And use code CRIBSIDERS50OFF to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code CRIBSIDERS50OFF at factormeals.com for 50% off plus free shipping. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor.
So I'll probably jump to the next question there that is talking about indications for surgery. So for you, what do you think the indications are for kind of doing each of these procedures if you need to do them?
So if the patient is having failure to thrive, so they're just not able to gain weight because they're working so hard to breathe, they're burning up all their calories and they're just not able to grow. Or if they are having retractions or cyanosis or apneas, and parents are kind of really worried that they're going to have, you know, stop breathing. So those are the most common reasons that we would actually recommend surgical intervention.
And I feel like these patients are often admitted to the hospital with, whatever respiratory piece that they have. And it's pretty scary, right? If I heard this sound and my kid was retracting, maybe still feeding well and doing things well, but we'll just say subcostal retractions. I kind of found the basic, but truly, retracting, they'd come to the hospital and they'd say, get evaluated in the emergency room, and someone would say, hey, this is laryngeal malacia. Is that someone you would kind of automatically go to surgery for, or is there kind of a spectrum? Obviously, apnea sounds the worst, but where do you kind of live in that realm?
So in terms of retractions, it's not unusual to have some intermittent retractions, especially if they are super agitated or, they just swigged a whole bottle of milk. So it depends on the severity of the retractions and, are they able to kind of get calmed down and breathe quietly again or not? But if they're in the hospital and they're sick, it's going to be worse. And so I probably wouldn't recommend surgery during that time anyway, because we certainly would not want to take a child who may have a respiratory virus and put them under anesthesia, and that could potentially make things significantly worse in the immediate perioperative period. But if it's something where they're having kind of constant retractions and we worry that they may ultimately actually potentially have a pectus related to that, that would be a reason to consider going ahead and doing something sooner than later. So we don't want to have them have deformation of their ribs because of their retractions. That's pretty uncommon, but that would be something to at least think about.
Yeah, and sorry, just to kind of keep trying to specify a little bit, I'm just curious from my end as a generalist, when I see this patient, what is that level of worrisome retractions for you? So again, that agitated kid who's, feeling a little agitated or just drank and has some subcostals, you don't really care that much from a surgical perspective. Is it the kid who's always intercostally retracting for continuously? Is that the kid that you're talking about, or somewhere in that spectrum of disease? I'm trying to figure it out so I know when I should be talking to ENT versus I got this.
Yeah. I mean, I think if they're having pretty significant persistent stridor with retractions. They're obviously having an increased rate, respiratory rate because of it. They may even be having like some cough in addition to that. Those are ones that we at least should evaluate and see what else is going on there and take a look and see if it is laryngeal malacia, make sure there's no other things that might be contributing to this.
And sorry guys for hogging this like completely about this, this level of care. My second one is, what about the kid, as you just mentioned, who is going to get sick, right? You know, whatever URI that they get, they buy themselves a hospital admission kind of each time. Is there a certain number of like, okay, you've been admitted for respiratory distress twice already in the first 6 months. So like your laryngeal malacia is probably contributing to this. So we should do something about it. Or do you kind of have a number like that? Almost like for what you would do for ear tubes, right? You know, if you have a certain number in the first 6 months or a certain number in the first 12 months, then you would go for tubes. Is there something similar from the laryngeal malacia surgery standpoint?
No, not really. There's not a specific like number of admissions that would trigger, okay, we have to go to the OR. It's more a matter of the big picture, the clinical picture. Are they maintaining their oxygen levels or not? Are they constantly desatting? Are they retaining carbon dioxide? Those are some of the things that would kind of make us consider, okay, maybe we need to take a look and see, is there some other things going on too, in addition to laryngeal malacia that might be a factor in all of these, in this big picture. So it really is a matter of looking at it over time and also looking at what's happening all around with the baby in terms of their development and their growth. And so that can help us determine whether and when to do something.
And I'm curious about sort of the overlap between ENT and pulmonology here, especially for these kiddos who have a little bit more severe disease and are inpatient. Do you often collaborate with pulmonology for other procedures on these types of babies?
Yes. So we will frequently do combo scopes where we will do a rigid endoscopy and then pulmonary will do a flexible bronchoscopy looking for distal bronchomalacia, or they may get a bronchoalveolar lavage sample and send that for culture and looking for streptolysin O to see if they're having any kind of aspiration. So we frequently work with them. We don't always, if it's a straightforward supraglottoplasty, we know the baby has laryngeal malacia, they're just not growing as well, or the parents are really nervous, but we're not worried about any potential lower airway disease. So not every laryngeal malacia baby that we take to the OR for a laryngoscopy or supraglottoplasty will get a scope by pulmonary, but definitely the ones that have been in the hospital for recurrent viruses or croup type episodes or just persistent hypoxia, tachypnea, those kinds of things, we will definitely work with pulmonary.
So one question I have is, so, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, these patients are being, who have been diagnosed with laryngeal malacia, some possibilities of, you know, different types of management with them, whether it's conservative management, whether surgical management, taking into account like how they're looking throughout time, whether they're sick or not. You know, As a parent, you know, I guess, how do you talk to parents about this diagnosis? I know, a lot of times we say, yeah, they'll likely outgrow it, but say they have a really severe laryngeal malacia, say they get surgery or they don't get surgery. How do you talk about like further prognosis through the rest of their life? Are they at risk for other respiratory conditions when they're older? What does that sort of discussion look like when you're talking to parents?
So we basically kind of talk about the natural history of the fact that most babies will outgrow this. Typically, parents will see drastic improvement around age 6 months, sometimes that's sooner. And we usually notice that it goes away completely around a year. Sometimes it's a little longer, especially in neurologically delayed children, and that we monitor them. We talk about the potential of reflux exacerbating the symptoms, the likelihood of laryngeal malacia all by itself contributing to other underlying respiratory problems is extremely unusual. So I wouldn't expect it to cause asthma or recurrent croup or reactive airway disease, which I think is on the spectrum of asthma anyway. But we monitor these children pretty closely. And I think that provides reassurance for parents that they're not just out there floundering and worrying and not having the support that they need. So we make sure that the essentially, the laryngeal malacia has resolved. So I do tell parents the likelihood that they're going to need a repeat scope is not zero, but it's extremely low. The ones that have had surgery, sometimes parents would like to do a repeat flexible scope to see the difference from the pre-op to the post-op. Not all of them do, and we don't always do that. If they're doing really well, there's no reason for us to do it, except my parents might want to just see what it looks like. So that's kind of the way I talk to them about it, is that, you know, this is a process, but it's fortunately something that should improve, and we'll monitor the baby all the way through to make sure it does.
I do want to ask a little bit more about the inpatient piece. I feel like from an outpatient, you know, we saw our baby Strider, you know, in the outpatient setting. And a lot of the times there, we're looking for baseline, either baseline retractions or difficulties with weight gain. Seems like the big thing that we're seeing in the outpatient setting. In the inpatient setting, though, I am curious about some management questions. You know, like say we have a patient who comes in with croup. They're going to be probably higher risk for developing croup. And so they come in with true respiratory distress, maybe they're hypoxemic or something like that. Are there any intervention you would recommend for someone with laryngomalacia?
So with laryngomalacia and croup, I would definitely manage the croup. You know, so typically you're going to do IV steroids and nebulized steroids and potentially racemic epinephrine and, you know, humidification. And in worst cases, you may end up actually to have to intubate the child, depending on how severe it is. The laryngomalacia shouldn't necessarily exacerbate the croup all by itself, but certainly can exacerbate just overall respiratory distress and stridor because you've got inflammation in the subglottis with the croup, and then you have this floppy supraglottis, and that may be inflamed as well because of the viral infection that caused the croup. So those children may end up needing to be in the ICU and potentially either on high flow or intubated, depending on what's going on. And so then the question is, okay, so you extubate them. Is their stridor worse than it was pre-op? Do we need to consider doing an airway scope or not? Are they extubatable? Sometimes they don't seem to be. You know, they start petering out and then they have to be reintubated. So those kids may end up needing to go to the operating room for a better airway evaluation. So those cases can sometimes be a little bit challenging, and the key is really having those conversations with the primary care team as well as the ICU team and the parents about, you know, this is what we would like to see, but this is what we'll do if we don't see that or if we see this happening.
Gotcha. Because I was curious if there was like, hey, because you have a floppy supraglottis, you know, would you do better with high flow or some sort of positive pressure to keep you open or something like that? And it sounds like, no, you would just generally kind of go along your pathway, but these kids could require, you know, higher level of care a little bit quicker and, you know, and then you would do your usual intubation piece if you have an obstructed airway and you can't protect it, that type of thing. Does that sound like a rough summary?
Yes. And it might be not the easiest intubation, because it could be difficult to see in there. So sometimes you might want some backup, either ENT or anesthesia, if you're in the ICU, to help with intubation, especially in a baby that you know may have, you know, moderately severe laryngomalacia. So let's say they have a epiglottis that's omega shaped and short AA folds. You may not see a whole lot of a glottic inlet to stick that tube. So sometimes it's helpful to call in your reinforcements ahead of time instead of scrambling after you've tried five times.
Yeah, I'm lucky I don't work in the ICU anymore. Goodness gracious. It sounds scary.
All right, Eileen, thank you so much for our discussions today. I do have one more question before we start wrapping up here. So are there any specific special populations that we need to be aware of as primary care providers, as general pediatricians that, you know, are likely, you know, have high risk for laryngomalacia and ways that we may need to approach those populations?
Yeah, so Down syndrome babies, because they have hypotonia and they also have bigger tongues. So their bigger tongues can kind of push the epiglottis posteriorly. And then the low tone can kind of cause more floppiness. Most people would try, if possible, avoiding doing supraglottic plasties on these babies. Sometimes you really don't have a lot of options, but most of the time we try to manage them by as conservatively as possible. Ultimately, they end up still needing sleep studies because of the tongue and because, you know, the AAP actually recommends doing sleep studies on children with Down syndromes up sometime before the age of 4 years old, even if they don't necessarily have significant obstructive symptoms. So those for sure. We also, kids who have cardiac histories may have a vocal cord paralysis, which sometimes can contribute to more obstruction. And so those kids may end up having a little more severe symptomatology than children who don't have vocal cord paralysis. Same thing with Chiari malformation kids. They may have vocal cord paresis or paralysis. And again, may be at somewhat higher risk of having more obstructive type symptoms.
Amazing. That was super helpful. So Eileen, would you be willing, that was a lot of information, would you be willing to try to distill everything that we talked about into just a couple of main pearls, main take-home points for our listeners?
Sure. So the first thing is laryngomalacia is the most common cause of stridor in infants and typically is something that will be self-limited, so they will outgrow it, which means that they don't typically need any invasive interventions, which is a good thing. There are definitely cases where they may require more involvement, whether it's medical interventions or surgical interventions, depending on how they do over time. And they ought to be monitored to monitor their growth, as well as their breathing and their sleep, to make sure that they do actually outgrow this without needing anything further.
Perfect. That was very succinct. I love that. And then lastly, do you have anything that you would like to plug on the podcast?
You mean related to laryngomalacia?
Or just in general?
ENT guidelines. Or I hear we have an upcoming episode with our friends, Peds on Call, on Acutitis Media or something like that, too. You know, anything else we should be checking out?
So, yeah. So the American Academy of Pediatrics is doing a webinar on acute otitis media, which I am one of the panelists on that. So we'll be talking about indications for meningotomy tubes and complications of meningotomy tubes and complications of acute otitis media, and things to look for, how to deal with chronic otorrhea, stuff like that. So that's actually being recorded next week.
Although Sam says that with the timing of our schedule, it's probably going to come out before this episode. So people go back and check it out afterwards.
It's inception. You know, it's recording after, but released before. It's going to be very interesting.
Time travel.
It's perfect.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the episode. I learned a lot, definitely things I probably should have known already, but I just didn't. So I really appreciate it. And I'm very sure that our listeners got a lot from this as well.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And feel free to reach out for any other additional questions or anything that comes up.
I think Harley already has a couple of ideas on further episodes to bring you back on. So
awesome. Well, this is a whole lot of fun. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get our show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Hartley Lidsky, our showrunner, and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I'm Hartley Lidsky.
And this has been Chris the Chi Manchu. Thank you, and good night. And if you made it all the way to the end, of course you're going to get a poem written by AI. It's titled, The Noisy Dance of Breath. Soft cartilage bends and sways, creating sounds through infant days. Laryngomalacia, gentle flow, makes breathing noisy high and low. In feeding time or peaceful rest, that inspiratory stridor tests our patients and parental hearts as supraglottic tissue parts. Worse when lying flat at night or when emotion runs just right. Better when the chin lifts high, position helps the breath flow by. Most will grow and time will heal. As month pass by, relief they'll feel. But when feeding struggles show, our growth is precious, slow and grow. Then ENT may need to see what flexibility might be, from watchful waiting gentle pace to supraglottoplasty's grace. Through stethoscope, we listen clear to sounds that parents learn to hear. This floppy larynx dance will fade as stronger airways slowly grade. See you guys.